You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new report finds more people with disabilities portrayed on TV, but fewer in movies. A guest gives us the details and tells us why it matters. Right now, it's time for our weekly review of news stories from around the state. First, a shooting in Wausau's Pine Grove Cemetery yesterday left one person dead and two injured. Police have a suspect in custody. Rob Menser is WPR's reporter based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, can you tell us what happened?
Police arrested a 64-year-old man named Henry West, who was a former employee of Pine Grove Cemetery, who left in 2012 and, according to police, did not leave on his own terms. He is accused of arriving at the cemetery on Thursday morning around 8:30 and shooting two employees and one person who was a family member of one of the employees. A 52-year-old woman died at the scene of the gunshot wound, and a 60-year-old man was treated. He's in critical condition at the hospital now, and a 70-year-old woman is in stable condition. She was hospitalized, but she's all right.
And this played out in real time, looking like an active shooter situation. Can you talk about the police response?
Yes. Pine Grove Cemetery is on Wausau's most heavily trafficked road, Grand Avenue, and this was happening right at the time that people were commuting to work. So yes, the police had to close down portions of that road and were, in a search for the shooter. There was a woman who was injured who flagged someone down in traffic to get help. However, the search did not last long. West was apprehended, was caught within about 15 minutes of the time of the shooting. So then it became a crime scene, an investigative site, and they spent most of the day on scene gathering evidence and analyzing what happened.
And lastly, Rob, you talked to some people near the cemetery, as I understand it. What did you hear from them?
Yeah, people were pretty worried. There were, it's a limited number of people who worked at the cemetery, and there were some people who are pretty well known in the community, and so people were pretty worried to find out how their friends were doing.
Rob, thanks for bringing us up to date.
Thank you.
That's Rob Menser, WPR reporter based in Wausau. He talked to us about a shooting in the city's Pine Grove Cemetery yesterday that left one person dead and two injured. Now, the Sheboygan County Memorial Airport is breaking ground on a new international customs facility. The project's part of the preparation for next year's Ryder Cup golf tournament in Kohler. Anne-Marie Hilton is the Streetwise reporter for the Sheboygan Press. Anne-Marie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, when and how did the push for this customs facility at the Sheboygan Airport first get started?
So the Sheboygan County Airport has been working with the Wisconsin Bureau of Aeronautics for about a decade on this project. And the main push has come from Kohler Company and other large corporations that have international sites.
And is this an airport that generally gets a lot of, passenger traffic right now?
So the airport doesn't do passenger travel. It does hobby planes or private planes.
And what is the need for international status here and to have a customs office at this airport that, again, doesn't get a lot of traffic or any actual passenger traffic?
Yeah, so there's a short-term need and then a long-term need for it. The short-term need is next year Sheboygan County is hosting the Ryder Cup. So lots of people will be coming from other countries to participate in that tournament or to just attend the tournament. So that'll serve as a good way for people to travel into the county. And then beyond that, it's a good opportunity for growth for the airport. The airport relies on fuel sales to generate revenue, and they're hoping that having a facility like this can bring in more people and help them become more self-sustaining.
Anne-Marie, from what you've seen in planning here, what does it take to turn a small airport into one that can actually take in international travelers?
Yeah, so what they're going to need to do is to construct a new building at the airport that will house the customs agent and the other administrative offices that are needed. They'll need to do a little bit of construction with the parking lot and other roadways. And so that should take about 6 months. It should be operable by next summer, and it'll take about $4.2 million to fund it.
Yeah, who's picking up the pay the tab here?
Yes, so $2.5 million is coming from the Bureau of Aeronautics, and then the rest of the money is coming from the capital project plan that the county has, so that's county taxpayer money.
And is the hope that this will be a revenue stream down the road that'll help pay some of that off?
Certainly. So the ultimate goal is to get the airport off of the county's tax levy. So they're hoping that this customs facility will bring in an influx of traffic that will increase fuel sales and things like that, that can help make the airport self-sustaining and not rely on tax money.
Now, this is probably not going to end up being a thing where somebody could be in Sheboygan and then go to the airport and hop on a, you know, a passenger plane to Paris. That's not the long-term goal here, right?
No, that's not the long-term goal. It's like I said, it'll remain with hobby planes and private planes, but they think there will be enough of an increase from that population alone to help bring in more revenue.
Anne-Marie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Anne-Marie Hilton is the Streetwise reporter for the Sheboygan Press. She talked with us about the Sheboygan County Airport getting a new international customs facility. Now we head south from there to Racine, where the city council has decided to rename part of the waterfront's Christopher Columbus Causeway. Adam Rogan is a reporter for the Racine Journal-Times. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, can you talk about the push to rename this part of this causeway?
So a couple of weeks ago, there was this group that came forward called Coming Together Racine, which is a basically just an advocacy group looking to combat racism in the greater Racine area. And they came to a City of Racine a committee meeting saying, like, we want to change the name of Christopher Columbus Causeway, basically because just citing the Christopher Columbus's less than favorable history with human rights abuses, having enslaved people in Native America, enslaved Native Americans, and then also, and of course, did plenty of abuses that led to possibly the death of millions. And then with that, they wanted to move forward with changing the name of the street because they didn't want to honor somebody like that. And then one thing that it got pretty strong support from the city council, and they approved it to change the name last week. Basically, they're going to change it to, I'm going to hopefully pronounce this right, the Kipikawi Causeway, which is the Potawatomi name for the river which runs through the city of Racine. So it's named after something that actually has something to do with Racine rather than Christopher Columbus, who never set foot here.
And this is an issue that can be controversial in many communities. Was there any pushback at this idea in the final meeting where they voted to change the name?
In the final meeting, the vote was not unanimous, but nobody spoke up. Even the city council members who voted against it didn't speak out saying why they didn't want it. There was some people in the community said they wanted to keep the name, saying like they didn't want to erase history or anything like that, but there was still... But the majority of at least the people who have spoken on this matter have been, you know, supportive of it, liking that it's named after something that actually matters to our community, being the river. And somebody on the city council, John Tate, said basically what I just mentioned earlier, that the city, that the Root River is actually something that matters to this community. Why don't we have this relatively important street running along the lake named after something that actually matters here, not somebody who died 500 years ago?
And the new name only applies to a portion of this causeway, I understand. Why is that?
That's kind of just a weird quirk of with Racine being right on the lake. The city of Racine controls the roads and streets up until the lakefront. The causeway actually runs out towards a marina and out to a restaurant along the lake. And so that part of the street is actually owned by the county, being actually kind of going into the lake. So what the city council has done, they've requested the county board saying, hey, can you change the name of this street so that it matches the rest of the street, so it matches the 400 feet we've renamed. And it's, again, funny that part of the street is, most of it, of this road is known as just 4th Street. It doesn't become Chris Columbus and now Kipikawi until right before the lakefront. So right now it's 4th Street through downtown, and then 400 feet of Kipikawi, and then about 1,000 or so feet out into the lake where it's still known as Christopher Columbus Causeway, although there's a chance they're going to be rectifying that in the next month or so at the county level, depending on how they take it.
Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
That's Adam Rogan, reporter with the Racine Journal-Times. He talked with us about the city's decision to rename part of the Christopher Columbus Causeway. He closed out our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup. Coming up, we'll find out what a new report shows about how many movie characters are shown with disabilities and what that means. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there's been a lot of immigration news under the radar this week amid all the impeachment news. We'll get the latest from new restrictions on refugees to the latest court rulings. First, the Annenberg Foundation recently released their annual report on representation and inclusivity in movies. Looking at 1,200 popular films, the researchers found that the percentage of people with disabilities shown in movies is at a four-year low. Lauren Applebaum is vice president of communications for Respectability, a nonprofit organization that fights stigma and advances opportunities for people with disabilities. WPR host Keely Boltina spoke with her recently.
The Annenberg study looked at different types of representation in films in 2018. So last year, everything from race to gender, LGBT people and people with disabilities. Let's focus on the people with disabilities. Over 4,000 characters with speaking parts were in films. How many of those had a disability in those films?
So I want to first say that the Annenberg study, it's really very important that it includes an analyzation of characters and people with disabilities, because most studies do not. In fact, when this Annenberg study first launched, it did not include people with disabilities. And then they've started including people with disabilities 4 years ago, which is very important, because without data, you can't really look at trends or try to advance any sort of change. And so for this year, unfortunately, it hit a four-year low, which is 1.6% of the speaking characters that they analyzed have a disability. And that is, it's really quite disappointing, because you always want to assume, it's really quite disappointing because you always would like to expect that numbers for representation and inclusion would go up. I feel that representation for female characters are increasing nicely. Characters who are people of color are increasing nicely. Now, there still needs to be a lot more done in both of those areas, but disability seems to be lagging far behind gender, sexual orientation, and race.
And that's just to have people see that. How does that 1.6% representation in film compare to the number of people with disabilities in the general population?
Sure. So most recent data shows that 1 in 4 American adults and 1 in 4 Americans identify as having a disability. So that's more than 25% of the U.S. population. There clearly is a huge disparity there between, you know, more than 25% versus 1.6%.
What contributes to that disparity and the decline that we've seen over the last few years?
I think the biggest issue explaining the disparity of why people with disabilities are so underrepresented, especially in film, is that we're just not on people's radars enough. And it's not an issue of people intentionally excluding people with disabilities for the most part. It's more of just not thinking about it. I met with an award-winning filmmaker who told me that for years, it's been drilled into him that he needs to ensure that his films include equal representation of women, equal representation of people of color, and more recently, equal representation of people who are LGBTQ+. But it was only until this past year or two that he's even heard about the importance of including people with disabilities. And he even said to me, "I know this is important. I understand why it's important. But I need you to remind me every time you hear about a new film coming out that I'm working on, make sure to reach out to me and say, hey, remember what you said when you promised that you were going to have equal representation of disability? Don't forget." Because he said, "I might forget and I don't want to forget." And I think it's just for, you know, decades where so many filmmakers have been really thinking about diversity in one way and not including disability in diversity conversations. And once disability is included in diversity conversations in a real authentic manner, then more people will be paying attention to including people with disabilities.
What do you tell those directors then, those filmmakers, about why it's important to have movie characters with disabilities, not just for people with disabilities to see themselves reflected, but people who don't have disabilities experiencing that on the screen?
Well, there are kind of two things there. One is what we see on screen influences how we act in real life. So when we see people with disabilities having jobs, getting married, doing everything that anyone else wants to do, then people without disabilities are much more likely to assume that people with disabilities are just as capable. And that can come when in the case of a teacher who has children with disabilities, especially learning disabilities. That can come in the case of an employer where someone with a disability comes in and they might be worried of, oh, how can this person do this job? Because I don't know how this person can do it. And I'll give a personal story. We run a fellowship program here, and there was a young woman with some various visual disabilities who applied for a fellowship with us that was going to involve video editing. And she told me she could edit videos. She sent me projects that she had done, and I was super excited to learn from her what tools she uses to be able to edit video, something that is an extremely visual medium. And she was very good at it. And there are people out there who might just discount her completely as a video editor simply because they realize that she has vision disabilities. And so when we see people on screen doing different things, that really changes our mindset in a way that learning in school doesn't really get to the point, but seeing it in popular culture really makes a huge difference. And the other thing is, we all know the entertainment industry runs on money. So I talk about some money stats. For example, according to Nielsen, the disability market is the third largest market in the U.S. and has a collective buying power of $1 trillion. And so when we can talk about how disability can help sell a movie money-wise, then filmmakers are much more likely to listen to that argument as well. Because even if they want to do the right thing, they want to also know that it can help in terms of helping the bottom line. And we've seen that happen with films like Black Panther, like Crazy Rich Asians, where by showing diversity, people want to come out. And it's not just people from that specific marginalized group, but kind of the whole American public wanting to learn about something that they might not know as much because it's not, you know, showing them over and over again. It's showing their neighbor, their best friend. And oftentimes filmmakers are looking for new stories. They're looking for stories that have not been told before. So by bringing in disability stories, because there's been so few that have been done well, then there's going to be an opportunity to really have that new innovative story.
We're talking with Lauren Applebaum, Vice President of Communications for Respectability. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're looking at a new report that shows that representation of people with disabilities is at a four-year low when it comes to popular movies. Lauren, what do we know about the actors portraying these characters with disabilities? Do they have the disabilities we see on screen, or are these actors who don't have disabilities interpreting what they think is life with a disability?
In most cases, when you see a character with a disability, the actor portraying that character does not have that disability. Now, I do see a trend over the last year or two, especially in television, of seeing more actors with disabilities being brought on, if not as the lead, but as a supporting role and actually having that disability. And so that gives me hope that that's going to carry over into the film industry and continue to grow in both television and film.
Do you think it's a fair analogy to talk about race? I mean, we see a lot of pushback in Hollywood about white actors playing other races. Should we think the same about disabilities?
So I think the issue of, you know, you hear a lot of actors saying, I want the opportunity to play a person with a disability. It'll give me an opportunity to expand my acting abilities. We also take a look and we see that a lot of Oscars that are given out to disabled characters are almost always played by an actor without that disability. And I think the only way that it will be acceptable for actors without disabilities to play characters with disabilities is for actors with disabilities to be able to be considered for all roles and really cast in all roles, disabled and without disabilities.
You mentioned that you see more progress on television than in movies. Your organization, Respectability, has identified that. What does that look like on the small screen?
Sure. So coming up this fall, I talked about surveys being so important. And coming up this fall, the GLAAD Media report, they talk about television, and they've been tracking disability for a very long time. And so that report will be coming out this fall. But anecdotally, I've had the opportunity to consult on a variety of television shows coming up soon, and really being able to see that executives are finally getting it and realizing the importance of having actors with disabilities as part of their TV shows. And one of the reasons they're finding is that it's a much more accurate representation. And you don't have to spend the time of learning how to portray a disability when you actually have an individual with that disability.
Lauren, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure being able to talk to you and your audience.
Lauren Applebaum is Vice President of Communications for Respectability, a nonprofit organization that fights stigma and advances opportunities for people with disabilities. She talked to WPR host Keely Boltina about a new report from the Annenberg Foundation that shows movie representation of people living with disabilities is at a four-year low. Coming up, we'll talk to an immigration reporter about changes the Trump administration is proposing to the country's refugee program, along with a lot of other top stories on immigration that might have been overshadowed in recent days because of all the talk of impeachment. We'll look at what's been going on in the immigration world. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7:30 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent talks to Wisconsin's new state veterinarian about the diseases that threaten pets, livestock, and wildlife, and how the state is working to prevent them. That's Monday morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, there's been a lot of news dealing with immigration lately. President Trump has moved to cap the number of refugees allowed to enter the U.S., and reporting from the New York Times revealed some of the surprising methods the president at one time floated for border defense, including mentions of a moat filled with alligators and shooting migrants in the legs to slow them down. Maria Sacchetti is an immigration reporter for The Washington Post. Maria, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Well, so much news out lately related to immigration, and I think in the public eye, often covered up by all the impeachment news. But before we get into the particulars, there's a lot going on, right?
There is. I mean, just mentioning, you were just mentioning the New York Times reporting on the snakes and other, the moats and things like that. I mean, my colleagues confirmed that information that, you know, even though the White House had denied it, and actually, you know, that my colleagues found that President Trump said that that he wanted U.S. forces with bayonets to also enforce, you know, the border, to control the border. So it's really been quite a time.
Let's start with the Flores settlement that has been in the courts a lot lately. Can you remind us what that dictates?
So this is a 1997 federal court agreement between lawyers representing immigrant children and the government, and they agreed a long time ago on a set of basic provisions for detaining migrant children, that they had to have, you know, they were supposed to be held in the least restrictive setting possible. They're supposed to be cared for, a lot of rules. And at the time, most of the children were unaccompanied. Now, you know, we're seeing that most of the children are actually with parents. And so what the Trump administration wants to do is expand family detention to deter like the record surge of families that across the border this year seeking asylum. But the judge in this case, who has overseen it for quite some time and was critical of the last administration too, said, look, that's not what the government agreed to in 1997. And this new proposal, just because you don't agree with it, you can't carry it out. So we'll see what the government does next.
Right. So what does that mean in practical terms for families detained while trying to cross the border? What is their current status?
Well, so the government has, until recently, the government had released tens of thousands of parents and children in the United States pending an asylum hearing. You know, they advocates say they're fleeing violence in their homelands and they're seeking protection in the United States. So, but right now, the government can only detain children with their parents up to about 20 days, and then most are released. However, right now, many families are not even getting into the United States to be detained. They're being pushed back to Mexico and threatened someday perhaps with the possibility of being sent back to Central America or other countries they pass through on their way to the United States to seek protection there instead. So the Trump administration's goal right now is to prevent people from even getting a foothold in the United States, because they say, you know, most people don't win their asylum claims and most people are never deported, even if they don't prevail in court.
Well, let's turn to another story that's very related to that, a Supreme Court ruling on asylum changes the administration had made regarding the rules of who is eligible to apply for asylum. What had the administration done here?
So the Supreme Court last month said the Trump administration could start denying asylum to people who traveled through a third country to get to the United States. And, of course, that applies to, you know, almost all the Central Americans who would have started their journeys in Honduras, Guatemala, or El Salvador, and then traveled through Mexico. And the idea is that they should have sought protection in Mexico instead. It's the first country they stepped into. And the White House's theory is that people are coming to the United States to work and not, or to join relatives, and not really seeking protection that they would be allowed to seek under the asylum law. But it's a complicated question. You know, these border cities in Mexico, where migrants are staying, they're unfamiliar. They don't have a lot of money. And they're quite dangerous. I mean, migrants have been kidnapped. There have been reports of rape and murder. People feel that they're in a lot of danger there. And they were, and those, you know, with legitimate asylum claims, really can't go back to their homelands. And people say, you know, perhaps someone from Honduras could seek refuge in Guatemala, but Guatemala doesn't have a strong asylum program, and even Mexico's is not as strong as the United States asylum program. And so they, people feel that migrants really don't have a lot of options, that that actually instead the United States should just use the asylum system it has and make it work, have people be interviewed by asylum officers, and if their claims are legitimate, then, you know, let them stay, and if they're not, then refer them for deportation.
Talking to Maria Sacchetti from The Washington Post. She covers immigration there, talking about a lot of different pieces of news related to federal policy on immigration and, in particular, the southern border. And, Maria, we've heard reports over the last, I guess, couple of years that the system for evaluating claims of asylum has been kind of overwhelmed. We have a backlog under what had been the present system of people seeking asylum and waiting to get that hearing.
Well, and this, I mean, there has been an enormous number of people surrendering at the border and claiming asylum. And that has definitely presented a challenge, you know, to the American authorities. I mean, they didn't have enough space to hold them. Children fell ill. Some had already been ill in the journey. They weren't able to provide medical care quickly enough. Some children died. And so there has been this influx, and there's been a lot of debate over how the government has responded to it. I mean, and I think it's a complicated situation, and there are many different sides and many different opinions about what's happening. People seem to agree that part of this is also fueled by smuggling. You see in Guatemala in particular, for example, smugglers were offering discounted trips, safe trips, you know, to people, parents who brought a child with them because they were aware at the time that they were likely to be released into the United States. But what is especially complex is that you have a mix of economic migrants and people, you know, seeking a better life in the United States. But you also have people fleeing, you know, brutal domestic violence, which the Trump administration has tried to make, you know, victims of domestic violence, make it harder for them to qualify for asylum. People fleeing gang violence, people fleeing hunger. And some are eligible for asylum and some perhaps are not. But the challenge for the U.S. authorities is, do you allow, how are you going to process their cases? How are you going to examine each case to make sure that you don't send someone back into a dangerous situation? That's one of the biggest questions right now. And a lot of people feel that the Trump administration's policies are not protecting people's right to seek asylum. You know, that there are people who are going to be swept into other countries who have legitimate claims and could be harmed or killed because the United States didn't adhere to its promises to, you know, to uphold its asylum laws.
Talking to Maria Sacchetti from The Washington Post, looking at some of the big immigration stories you might have missed in the midst of all the impeachment proceedings. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of some of these changes to asylum policy, to refugee laws, lowering the number of refugees able to come into the country? We'll talk about that in just a few moments. Do you have a question for our guest about some of the latest news you're seeing on these various immigration issues? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about some of the big immigration-related stories from recent weeks. Maria Sacchetti is with us from The Washington Post. You can join in with your questions and thoughts at 800-642-1234. We'll bring on a caller now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I was wondering, does the federal government have anything like eminent domain where they could take somebody's land to put up a fence or border wall? And if it does... could states' rights allow a state to say, no, we're not going to allow that?
Dennis, thanks for the call. This is a recurring issue, Maria. It came up, I think, in that New York Times reporting, among other places, about whether the government, federal government, has access to land to build the wall.
Right. And so, that is something that is unfolding on the border and has been really since the mid-2000s. And there are many, many lawsuits that are pending, and they're the government is trying to do that, and the government is trying to build the wall, especially in areas where it really doesn't have to deal with that problem, you know, so they can put it up more quickly. But I know of several lawsuits that have been pending over slivers of land, you know, just pieces of it, and they've been pending for years. So it's not easy in this country, you know, to take away someone's land. And so you know, it really varies depending on where you're looking.
Thanks for that call. Dennis, want to get into the refugee cap. It's been cut under the Trump administration over the years. What is the latest on the country's refugee program?
So the president, the White House recently said that it plans to reduce the cap to 18,000, which is the lowest it's been since the program was created 4 decades ago. So this is and it's already much, much lower. I mean, when President Obama had set it around 110,000 in his last year in office. And so fewer than that got in. But it is still much more generous because it was at a time when and it still remains so when the number of refugees worldwide is really enormous. Millions and millions of people have been displaced from Syria, from seeing people in from Venezuela, from really all over the world, Congo. And so this has a very significant effect.
And that 18,000, I understand there are carve outs within that as to where some of those 18,000 are dedicated to certain parts of the world and certain issues. Is that right?
Correct. I mean, so there, where before it was, there were carve outs for people from different parts of, for example, the largest group was from Africa, and then there were others, you know, from Latin America and Asia and things like that. But now it will be certain. It will dovetail with the administration's policy priorities. So, like, there were carve-outs for people fleeing religious persecution and other reasons. So,
and let's take it back, Maria, to where we started out with. We're getting some inside scoops from your colleagues and from the New York Times on what went on and what has gone on within the Trump administration. Some frustration at various points about the inability to enact some of their policies. What do we know now that we didn't maybe a week or two ago?
Well, I mean, there's I mean, if you're an immigration reporter nowadays, you're just constantly being hit with new information all the time. I mean, I think the Trump administration's frustrations have been ongoing. So you have this political tornado, right, where we're talking about the president's musings, you know, on bayonets and snakes and the ways to control the border that aides really did not take seriously. I mean, they obviously did not, you know, have forces equipped with bayonets at the border. We don't have a moat, you know, at the border. But you know, the president has claimed that that's all fake news. But my colleagues have also verified the New York Times report. But separately, you have a lot of things that are taking place that are having a real impact on immigration. The Trump administration has tried to limit legal immigration, and they have done that where they can. And the refugee cap is one very good example of that. But there's other ways where they're kind of throwing sand in the gears of the legal immigration system, demanding more evidence, you know, for people trying to petition for their relatives or for asking for visas, things like that. And then they're also having a real impact at the border. I mean, over the past few months, you had this enormous, number come in of folks come in May, 144,000. But since then, it has steadily declined. It's still high, you know, which is frustrating to President Trump because he campaigned on really lowering immigration levels and definitely securing the border. Those were his big campaign promises, and he has not been able to keep them. But the difference now, and it's quite serious, is that the border crossings of the past year are not the border crossings of the 1990s or the early 2000s, when it was mostly single adult men, you know, coming over to work. I mean, now you're seeing, you know, about one in three apprehensions, so to speak, you know, are children, and they're younger than ever. And so when you're talking about, you know, this kind of crackdown and talking about a big wall and talking about bayonets, I mean, you're talking about, you know, kids under 12.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Maria Sacchetti from The Washington Post taking us on a whirlwind tour of a lot of the top immigration stories out of Washington. Across the U.S., small rural hospitals are closing, arguably where they're needed most. But some hospitals in Wisconsin have managed to survive or even thrive. They've done this by forming partnerships, offering unique services, and getting creative about doctor recruitment. Shemaine Mills tells us how hospitals are holding their own.
People live in the country to get away from it all, but that soothing solitude can change suddenly. Emergencies often have ordinary beginnings, and this one did. It was a meal Karen Hageman can't forget because it almost killed her. At home with her husband, a piece of steak got stuck in her throat. She recalls thinking, I may need a tracheotomy so I don't suffocate.
Kimball was maybe a 20-minute drive from the hospital, and I remember choking and thinking, oh my God, he's got to get me to a hospital.
Kimball's a tiny town in northern Wisconsin where you're more likely to hear the rumble of logging trucks than the screech of an ambulance siren. It's so far north, the nearest hospital is across the border in Michigan. These critical access hospitals, as they're called, dot the rural landscape. They provide life-saving care, but many of the hospitals themselves need a little TLC. One-fifth of Wisconsin's 76 rural hospitals are losing money. 6 years ago, Memorial Medical Center in Neillsville couldn't get a bank loan, recalls Chief Administrative Officer Ryan Neville.
2013, we had 4 days cash on hand. We lost $3 million that year.
To shore up its finances, the hospital became part of Marshfield Clinic. A national group which analyzes the healthcare industry has looked at such partnerships. Michael Topchick from the Chartis Center for Rural Health says he's seen the good, bad, and ugly of these business arrangements across the U.S., but generally he said they result in better patient outcomes and a stronger bottom line.
So I think affiliation in general is it's something to seek out. Strategically, and you know, the local community can make a decision strategically about how much control do we want to give up, how much independence do we wish to keep. But of course, that's going to be definitely proportional then to the resources you receive.
Independent hospitals are dwindling in Wisconsin. One still open is in Viroqua, where the steep hills of western Wisconsin offer tremendous views, but the winding roads are treacherous travel for the mix of cars, tractors, and Amish buggies. In 2004, retired dairy farmer Jim Service had both knees replaced at the local hospital. Vernon Memorial Healthcare is known for having good outcomes with joint replacement surgeries, and a doctor there will operate on both knees at once, something many orthopedic surgeons won't do.
All I heard is good about him, and I'm like, go see this guy. A couple of my neighbors got their knees replaced, and they said, hey, he's good. So I wasn't going to question that. And all three of us had double knees done.
Specializing in lucrative joint replacement or cardiac care is one way small rural hospitals are trying to attract more patients. Hospitals are also trying to find an untapped segment of the healthcare market. Toma is a central Wisconsin community of 9,000, but attracts patients from further out because the hospital delivers babies underwater in a giant tub at the hospital. But in order to attract more patients, you need doctors to treat them. And it's easier to recruit in urban areas than out in the country, says Tim Size, executive director of the Rural Wisconsin Health Cooperative.
I know hospitals that have trouble recruiting people. They've actually got someone to say, I want to come work with you. And then when they look at what housing's available and what child care is available, they say they just simply can't make it work.
Some rural Wisconsin hospitals, like the one in Neillsville, have brought in doctors from other countries under a special visa program. In addition, the state's two medical colleges have been training future doctors in rural areas in the hopes they'll put down roots. What's at stake isn't just a hospital for patients. It's also jobs for community members. Remember Karen Hageman, who nearly died choking on a piece of meat? She worked at the local hospital. People would miss it, she said, if it were gone. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This report is part of a collaboration of 12 newsrooms, including Wisconsin Public Radio, led by Iowa Watch and the Institute for Nonprofit News, with additional support from the Solutions Journalism Network. For more, visit hospitals.iowawatch.org. Coming up Monday on Central Time, a whistleblower is at the center of national news, just in time for our guest author's new book on whistleblowers. We'll find out what they do, what legal protections they have, and how we figure out who the laws apply to. Former Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson joins the show to make the case for the updated NAFTA treaty called the USMCA. He says it'll have big benefits for medical innovation. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Monday at 6, Kate's guests tell us how we can help kids improve their mental health and deal with their emotions in a way that helps them learn at school. That's Monday at 6 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then on this week's edition of Food Friday, we're talking pizza, specifically pan-style pizza in all its glory. Our guest is the breadmaster, Peter Reinhardt. He's got some great recipes to share. Get started now if you want at wpr.org/foodfriday. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.